Hey, beautiful people. Welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEWLP Brattleboro. I'm your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and this is where we talk about how everything in Montpelier shakes out for the rest of us. And now that the session is officially open in Montpelier, the new biennium has begun with lots of fanfare and lots of singing at the opening session on the 9th, I guess, was the gubernatorial address or the inaugural address. We can now officially look for things shaking out in Montpelier and what they will mean on this show. So I'm looking forward to the upcoming session and all the conversations we will be having. And I'm very looking forward to today's conversation because two of my favorite people are here. Journalist John Walters from the Vermont Political Observer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm the one with the beard.
Just in case anyone gets confused. And the lovely Leah McGrath Goodman, another wonderful journalist, extraordinaire, is also here today. Hello, Leah. So glad you're here.
Good to be here.
And is it official? Can we applaud your completion of your master's degree?
Yes, I just completed a master's degree in corruption and governance. Ready
no
to
small
use it.
Feat. Yeah, again, ready to use it. Government systems, beware. You are being watched.
We are talking about governance today, so...
We are, and where I'd love to start is with the governor's inaugural address, which I found equal parts scolding and uplifting. He did end on a very positive note, talking about how Vermonters can really come together for their communities. I'm curious for John, what was your takeaway?
Well, I think I'm in the same place you are. By Phil Scott's standards, it was, pretty good oratory and less scolding and more uplift than I expected to hear from him. He came in with, having won re-election by a landslide and having substantial Republican gains to support him in the House and Senate. And, he could have come out and spent, a half hour dunking on the Democrats if he'd wanted to. And instead, he spent about 10 minutes dunking on the Democrats. And then he turned to some of his priorities for the session. And then he closed with a very nice section, a very well done section, talking about things that Vermonters do and have done and have accomplished to make Vermont a better place by working together. And the number one item on his list was the fact that Vermont has accepted more than 1,000 refugees in the last 3 years. And I thought that was and he got a standing ovation from the whole chamber for that. And I thought that was very significant because he is a longtime and noted and public critic of Donald Trump. And that seemed to be aimed directly at Trump. Although, the governor did not make that connection overtly. To put that first place at a time when we don't know what's going to happen to immigration policy and Trump is making threats about deporting people en masse, I thought that was a marker of, the kind of civility that Phil Scott does engage in, but not as often as he gets credit for. But in this case, it was a nice thing to hear. This was the ceremonial speech. In 2 weeks, he will deliver his budget address, and that's where we will get the details, and that's where we might get more of the, bashing of the Democrats and, assertions that, he has a mandate and that the Democrats should, usually when he says, let's come to the table and work together, it means let's come to the table and agree on my ideas. So we shall see what he comes up with in the budget address and what his approach is to being collaborative with the legislature, which still does have substantial Democratic majorities.
Mm-hmm. Leah, I'm curious about your take. And one reason I'm really excited to have both you and John on today's show is, John has been deep into Vermont politics for many, many years. And you do a lot of investigative, really deep investigative work, but it's on a national level. You're not enmeshed in Vermont politics the way John and I can be, or especially John, because he's smarter than me. So I'm really curious about your takeaway, living in Vermont, but not being enmeshed in the press world of Vermont.
Yeah, and I have to say, I am very disembodied from the, as John had called it, the media scene of Vermont. I'll occasionally write something, I'll occasionally befriend a journalist or an editor here and do some work with them or do some project, but I'm not involved in the media in Vermont in the sense of really the word scene is so foreign to me when it comes to Vermont media. If there is one, I don't know of it. Maybe there is one. But when it comes to the speech that we heard, his inaugural address, and by the way, the biennium, this word that everybody's using, biennium, it's such a big, meaty word for what it is, which is
For
like
2 years.
a 2 year period. It's funny. I'm seeing it in all the headlines, and of course, the wordsmith in me just kind of has to laugh. Like, do we have to make it sound so over the top? But
Well, oh yes, we must be proud of the hard work we are doing.
it's
It's
a
a
little
little
there's a
much.
pod, there's a podcast called The Press Box, which I listen to. It's about the media, and one of their staples is the only in journalism words that you will only find in news media reports. They don't exist in real life.
Oh, I
And
love it.
I think biennium is probably one of those.
It is. I was turned off, obviously, or else I wouldn't have pointed it out. That being said, I because I'm not involved in whatever the scene is or the contexts here, and I do follow the issues definitely, but I'm not involved in all the what I would call the energy and vibe around all of it. Strong vibe situation here in Vermont at all times, as we know, but I didn't find it remotely scoldy for the first part. He looked like he was giving a pretty straightforward address. He's addressing issues. And by the way, I'm an independent. If anyone's like, what is her politics? I'm a journalist, so being partisan is not part of the job unless you want to proclaim that you want to write only for one party's interests. In my case, I'm just I write too much about politics and news, so I have to really stay outside of the back and forthing other than covering it as a journalist. But I felt like he was addressing some pretty serious issues where people are at a crisis point in the state, and it seemed like he was trying to bring to bear how serious it is and how important it is to address these things, specifically making it possible, not just affordable, but possible to even be here. And to support oneself and have any shot at having a home and planning for the future. And hopefully, if you have a family, raise a family, addressing things like housing, education, taxes, all those things are at a pretty serious crisis point. And to the point where, as somebody who's lived here for over a decade, I do not believe there's any economic reason to be here. Every single day I spend here is hurting myself economically, and I know it. And so you have to find reasons why you have to literally look in the mirror and say, why am I staying here when the financial picture is so bleak and it's heading in a direction that looks like it's going to be more or less uncontrollably bleaker because we're having a lot more people in need of the support services we need to pay for, including the elderly coming in and a lot fewer workers and people in their prime staying. So that for me, that's a big deal. We want to support young people, we want to support the elderly, but how do we get that missing middle back, a middle class that's going to create an economy again? And Olga knows this, and so when he's scoldy, I'm thinking to myself, if we don't get that, our goose is cooked. So he could have scolded a lot more, in my opinion.
As someone who lives outside the Brattleboro bubble, and in a rural community, and has recently been doing work for VBM, and I did a recent article for looking at the Northeast Kingdom. I have to say, I did appreciate his talking about the left behind communities. I wouldn't necessarily call them that. And I'm kind of cautious of using the phrase two Vermonts, but I do think that is something
I
in
think
this
it's been
state.
copyrighted anyway.
What's that?
I think it's been copyrighted anyway.
Oh, well, there you go.
There's a few books.
Yes, they're books on my shelf that I keep meaning to read that I have not gotten there yet. But I do think that is something we need to wrestle with in Vermont is while the economy is bleak, Leah. The other thing I often remind Leah of is yes, but remember you're also in Brattleboro, which has a very its own bubble, and that elsewhere in the state other things may be happening. But I do think that the economic growth in this state is extremely uneven, in a way that is concerning and is dragging us down, you know, when you've got some areas like, you know, Chittenden County might be doing well, but we can't expect Chittenden County to run the entire economy for an entire state. You know what I mean? And in southern Vermont, Bennington and Brattleboro, we can't expect those two towns to do the heavy lifting as well. So one thing I did appreciate about his speech was talking about that unevenness. I thought that was good. But the other thing I'll just push back a little bit on is I was saying for listeners before the show, I was telling Leah and John how much Governor Scott reminds me of my stepdad, who I love dearly. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. But sometimes it seems like Scott and my dad had the same feeling about how you spend money and what affordability means. And while Scott was giving his speech, I had this flashback to a fight my dad and I had. He was also my mechanic. And I was driving this car that had an electrical issue. So every time I drove, the electric locks would go click, 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 click. And when I parked, if I was going to be parked for more than 20 minutes, I had to disconnect the battery. Otherwise, it would be dead by the time I got back to the car. And then the other thing I had to do before I could start the car up again is reconnect the battery. But then I had to get down on the ground. It was a standard. And I had to put the car in neutral and then reach up under the clutch pedal and find a little pin and push the pin and then feather the gas pedal to get the car to start. And my dad and I had a fight about this because I was like, Dad, the car doesn't work. Like a car is supposed, you're supposed to be able to turn the key, it turns on, and you go from point A to point B safely. And my dad was like, it's a car. Like you have a car. Just be happy you have a car. And sometimes I feel when Scott's talking about money, that's sometimes what he's telling us is that just be happy, like you have a car. The fact that you have to crawl on the ground and get it to start because the clutch isn't working, that doesn't matter. You have a car. Just be happy. And I say I feel that's backed up by data from the Public Assets Institute that looks at the way the state has underinvested in itself for many decades. So a lot of our systems are not operating properly. And so when it comes to delivering services and that type of thing, everything's a little bit out of whack. And I realized that was a bit of a tangent, but that's my one concern with some of Scott's approaches is there's being affordable and then there's underinvesting. And sometimes in Vermont, we confuse the two. We think that delayed maintenance will save us money when it really doesn't.
Sorry, I'm confused a little bit. Did
What, you didn't
Scott?
follow my stories about cars
I
and state
totally followed
budgets?
it. I totally followed it. So, for purposes of this conversation, I'm not talking about Brattleboro. I'm talking about Vermont and all of the data that I have seen. And we were talking about Governor Scott's inaugural address and what he said about the state. So we're talking about that. The fact Brattleboro is having all kinds of issues right now, to me, is not what this conversation should be about, because we're addressing, the state politics, what's going to happen statewide. Vermont has the smallest economy in the United States. Vermont's economic outlook is at the very bottom of all the states. I think it's at 49. With the smallest economy and one of the worst outlooks, these problems are absolutely real. And I don't know if Governor Scott made a comment about not investing in infrastructure, or has said, let's not invest in infrastructure. I didn't hear that. But he did say, not survive, but thrive. So I feel like some of what we're kind of laying at his feet, I didn't see how it is he's saying we need to just struggle through. I kind of heard it the other way. So if I miss something, I just want to make sure I'm
No,
following.
I think you're correct. I think in his speech, that's exactly what he was saying. My concern is sometimes his approaches to things don't necessarily follow that. How he might define thriving, when you finally look at his approach to an issue, it's not the same outcome.
Is there an example of where he kind of put something obvious in the back burner that he should have put in the front? That, I guess, can we talk about it?
Sure. John, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the examples might be in many of the bills he vetoed over the years.
Well, he has vetoed a ton of bills. He years ago surpassed the all-time record for vetoes by a Vermont governor, and he has since added to that substantially. I think there is a general theme in his administration where he talks about issues, he talks about addressing issues, but he is unwilling to invest in making progress in the issues. And this is where he differs from the Democrats. The Democrats, Windham County Senator Wendy Harrison just wrote an opinion piece that I think Digger published recently about this. If you're stuck in a situation where you do face major issues in education and healthcare and housing and et cetera, do you say, as Governor Scott has often said in the past, we can't afford to try to address this? He did it with broadband. The only reason we're making progress on broadband is because of the pandemic and the flood of federal money we got afterward. The Democrats would say, in order to get out of this situation, we need to make some targeted, strategic, smart investments, even if it costs some money up front, like the childcare bill they passed a couple of years ago. And that will lift us out from where we are now. And in the long run, those investments will pay off if we do it right. So this is where we get into the details, and we will get the details when the governor comes out with his budget address. If he does come up with ideas to address some of our problems in creative new ways, then I think he will deserve some applause for that. It hasn't been his pattern in the past, and he has been governor for a long time already, and most leopards do not change their spots, but we shall see. Just about everybody in state government agrees with the list of issues that we face. Where there is disagreement is how we address them.
I'm trying to get a handle on, and I'm like the foil here because I'm still the outsider. Like, I follow the issues and I listen to the speeches, I read the columns. But it sounds like if there's not enough money to pay for everything that is needed, then you have to decide what comes first, right? What comes in, like, what gets right now, we know education is pretty much the big burner of funds and needs to be addressed urgently so that people can continue living in their homes and make some kind of life here. But is he actually saying, when is he looking at as Olga says, you're looking at specific things that need addressing, not addressing them when there's money sitting right there to do it and no one can figure it out why? Or is he just trying to overall make sure that there's not constant tax increases that affect everybody when they can barely make ends meet already? I guess that's the part I'm not quite clear on.
Well, I'll give an example of this, and you know, I'll say for the record, in case anybody's never heard me talk before, I am a retired journalist. I no longer practice journalism in the conventional sense. My blog makes no bones about the fact that I am a liberal. So there you go. That said, the governor has talked since he originally ran for office in 2016. About the need to overhaul our education system, including public schools and secondary education, you know, colleges and universities that are grossly underfunded and under-resourced. Mm-hmm. And he puts that all under the rubric of cradle to career, a phrase that he used again in his speech. And what he seems to mean by that is sort of some sort of unification of K through 12 and college and university, the public sector of it anyway.
And to be fair, on paper, it sounds really exciting.
Yeah, the problem is he has never actually delivered a concrete proposal for how to do that. And to me, the reason that he has never done that is that he knows it would be unpopular. He knows that, you know, it would step on a lot of toes. It would probably mean less funding for the public schools and more funding, maybe more funding for the colleges and universities. But it would definitely be another drain on the public schools. So he has never delivered a proposal. I would love to see a proposal from him. I don't know that I would agree with it, but I would love to see him actually set himself, put some of his massive political capital on the line and deliver a concrete proposal to actually address it. And in his inaugural speech, he indicated that such a proposal was coming, and we shall see when he delivers his budget address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is all this mainly a function of there's just not enough money? I mean, it sounds, I guess the reason, and by the way, I am not somebody who, I think I recently voted for, just to give myself away, I think I recently voted in the election for Governor Scott, but didn't initially, and have never been somebody who felt, you know, I'm certainly not a fangirl, if you will. It's more like, okay, I guess we have, you know, hold my nose and vote. That being said, so not to say that, and so I don't want to look like I'm defending him, but it just,
no, you can defend him if you think enough, he needs it.
Like, there literally doesn't seem to be enough money. The idea that there's anyone withholding fabulous benefits from these very just causes seems to be this idea. And so I'm struggling a little bit with the idea that he's somehow withholding this from all of us. It sounds like there's not enough money to go around, and it's really just down to how do we thread the needle knowing it's not going to be what we'd all love because there's literally not enough resources to do all these things. So it's really a debate about like what, you know, probably a compromise over how it works, but it seems unfair to just blame him. That's my.
Yeah. I see what
you're saying. There's money here.
No, I think you are right, Leah, in that there's not enough money to go around. And I think where, at least for me, the rub is, and I'll go back to the vetoes, that his many vetoes.
Yeah, like what did he veto that was so, I was waiting to hear, like the veto that did X was outrageous.
Well, I think it's the process of the vetoes in that we've gotten ourselves, in my opinion, in Vermont, because there's not enough money and because there's been a lot of delayed maintenance, a lot of our problems have really interwoven. And so to start solving them, you need to pull a lot of levers at once. And so you really need these kind of interwoven policies. I think our child care bill from a few years ago pulled multiple levers at once. And so, there is some disagreement between members of the legislature and Scott about which lever should be pulled and how much money should go to each lever. That's to be expected in my view. And I think actually that's healthy. Where I get frustrated with Scott is like with the vetoes, he has how many months to sit down with lawmakers and say, I don't like this part. I don't like this part. Let's work here. Here's my proposal here. Like he has how many months to do that? And he won't do it. And then at the end, he'll be like, well, because I don't like X, Y, and Z, I'm vetoing this. So it creates like an all or nothing situation rather than one of collaboration and the hard work that he says we're all supposed to be doing. Am I off base with that, John? Please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, his vetoes are kind of basically roughly in two pots. One is seemingly persnickety objections to something where if he had stepped in earlier, and you hear legislative leaders all the time complain that he does not engage with the legislature in ways that previous governors did. So there are those vetoes where it seems like if he had just like flagged it for the legislature's attention, they might have been able to reach agreement. The other are the big issues where the Democrats and the governor just disagree, like climate legislation, for instance. So, you know, there are, so those are the two pots. I think we don't need to spend a lot more time litigating the Phil Scott experience. I do think that, you know, as Leah said, you know, there is a need for collaboration, and both sides at this moment are making the right noises. You know, the governor did reach a hand to the Democrats. The Democrats have responded to the election by giving Republicans significant more say in the legislative process. You know, Republicans have more committee chairs, more vice chairs. They are being invited to take a more active hand in leadership than they had when they had tiny, tiny minorities. So everyone right now is setting the stage for a collaborative approach. You know, after seeing how things have gone for the last not only Scott administration, but even before that, I have my doubts that that will actually happen, but it would be great and refreshing if it did. And you know, maybe if in that respect, if that happens, then the election will have had a positive effect on our politics because it will have forced politicians on both sides to find common ground and find ways to address our problems in a manageable fashion.
So the sorry, so the just to follow what you're all saying is it's more about how he engages with the process that has been a turnoff for a lot of people who are covering it, watching it. It looks like he's not collaborating on the nuts and bolts. And then
That's
he'll just sort of sit there and be like, no.
yeah. Well, no,
Okay.
and then he'll sit there and be like, it was the legislature's fault.
But he'll like outsource all responsibility to them. And then if he doesn't like the, it's like having no part in cooking the pie. And then when the pie is presented, being like, I don't like pecans. And that's it.
I
Okay.
think that's a good summary.
I can see why that would not be an enjoyable situation. Thank you.
I
Go ahead,
imagine
John.
if you asked him over a beer, you know, why he doesn't engage, he would probably say, well, the Democrats run that roost and I really can't have much of an effect. And now that there are more, a lot more Republicans in the legislature, he doesn't really have that excuse, if that is his excuse, anymore. So, you know, he does have allies in the state house and he has enough of them and enough of them in positions of influence, that he should have a fair shot at dealing with legislative leaders. And again, the leaders are making the right noises right now about their willingness to meet with the governor and find common approaches to the problems we face.
Right. I mean, even if it wasn't if it was intractable in the past because he didn't have enough of that prior, it still doesn't seem to totally defend not sitting down and trying to at least walk each other through each other's thinking. You know, you may not agree with someone, but if he believes his positions are reasonable, which I believe he does, even if the other side disagreed, you'd think he'd at least want to sit down and say, "Hey, this is why I'm coming from this direction. Persuade me otherwise." You know, or it just sounds, it's surprising to me that it would have been that uncollaborative to not even, like you said, sit down and at least have a beer.
On that
Hi.
note, folks, we are out of time in this first half of the Montpelier Happy Hour on WVEW LP Brattleboro. So hang tight. We're going to hear from some underwriters and then be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. I am your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with two journalists extraordinaire, John Walters and Leah McGrath Goodman. Very glad to have them on the show. In fact, we hardly got back to the show because during the break we had as great a conversation as we had on air. Sorry, guys, you missed out. Before I jump back into the conversation, I just want to quickly thank BCTV for taking the video version of this show, sharing it with media centers around the state, and want to remind listeners that the views and opinions of everyone on the Montpelier Happy Hour are ours and no one else's, not the radio stations, not BCTV's, not anyone else's. We are solely responsible for whatever comes out of our mouths, good, bad, or ugly. Okay, on that note, Leah, I'd love to take a minute or two to circle back to something you said during the break when you were talking about, you know, the change, how big a change it was for you to move to Vermont, and just you were talking about bills. And I wanted to echo that because when I lived in London, even though London is one of the most expensive places in the world, so they say, I paid less for housing in London than I did when I moved back to Brattleboro. So yes, things are out of kilter, but I'd love to hear your experience about like what it's been for you moving to Vermont.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was hard. I absolutely wanted to be here. I wanted for some time to, I'd been looking for sort of my dream little mountain idol town. And even when I was living in New York City and sort of, you know, living the life, I found an old book the other day, and in the back of it, I wrote, "What about your rural life?" Like, and it was like a something I had written to myself when I was young, saying, "Why haven't you done this yet? Like, this is something you really wanted." And I read it the other day and thought, "Ha ha ha ha! I was so naive." But I have been here for over 10 years, and I was just saying during the break, I've lived in New York City, I've lived in Boulder, Colorado, I've lived on an island off the coast of France, which was a tax haven, and London, England, and I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and I have never had so many bills coming in as I've had in Vermont. You know, you have the trash bill, you have the water bill, I have a heating oil bill, I have a propane bill for my stove and my fireplace. You know, you have your mortgage or your rent, you have your electric bill. You know, in New York City, sort of you get all your electricity and heat and everything through one bill. And you know, you have your housing bill, which is renting, or your mortgage, and you have to pay for the internet, but you don't have to like update your car all the time because it's rotting in the snow and the ice and the salt. And there's just so many things up here you're paying for all the time. And I couldn't believe the fuel bills when I got here. I was gobsmacked, and I had a tiny little house. So things like that are just shocking. And they added the water bill and the trash bills. They kept increasing the water bill. I kept being confused because I lived in the desert when I lived in Boulder. It's the desert. And I think my water bill came to maybe $3 to $5 a month. Out here, it's at least $40 a month, if not 50. It's just wild. And we're not living in a desert, the last I checked.
Thank you for that perspective. Well, what it reminds me, Leah, and why I wanted to bring it up too is, talking about economics, there's so much of economics are so much about the decisions we make. And one thing I'm very tired, one narrative I'm tired of hearing is the Vermont tax. Vermont, there's so many wonderful things about being here.
Yes.
Obviously, the three of us wouldn't be here. But this idea that it's okay if we get paid a little less, or it's okay if we have to pay a little more, because Vermont is such a wonderful place that you're willing to pay what they call the Vermont tax. And I'm actually really tired of that. I think it's an excuse to let the unbalanced economy spin out the way it's been spinning out. I don't know, John, what do you think?
Well, I know that most employers, maybe all employers, impose a tacit Vermont tax because salaries generally are substantially lower in Vermont than they are elsewhere. And one of the things that drives young people to leave Vermont for professional opportunity elsewhere is that they can move to Albany or Boston or Chicago or, Des Moines, and
Oh,
make.
heck, they can move to Keene, New Hampshire, or Greenfield, Massachusetts, even.
And make substantially more money and probably pay less in taxes than they do here. And some of that is because of those damn Democrats in the legislature. Some of it is just things like there's so much stuff in Vermont that's kind of old and crusty, and it's the way we've always done it. And it really ought to be, a fresh look ought to be taken at a whole array of things. But there's little to no appetite for doing that in Vermont. So things just kind of keep on rolling in ways that are functional, but far from ideal, I think. We're getting far afield from a discussion of Vermont politics and how things play out in wherever you are watching or listening to this. But there's a lot going on with this whole issue of affordability and the cost and benefits of being a Vermonter. It's
I
a
think it does tie back, though, to the whole the people have spoken mentality of the speech, right? Like, we're not too off course with that in the sense that it connects back to the address and what he was saying about, Vermonters can't really take anymore. He quoted from a few people who said they're barely making it or they don't think they're going to make it.
I think the crowning blow in all of this was the property tax increases in the last couple of years have been extraordinary, and that was driven in large part by a reform measure the legislature passed in 2023 that, as it turned out, had unintended effects and caused school spending to go to rise dramatically. And our system, as the governor said in his speech, the local school districts pass their budgets, and then the state is obligated to pay for all those budgets. So there is a disconnect between how much is being spent and who's paying for it. That is an
I
issue.
actually really appreciated the clarity he brought to that. I thought that was good.
That is an issue that needs to be addressed, and the school funding system is in severe need of an overhaul. The devil's going to be in the details, and again, we shall see in his budget address where he stands on how to pay for the schools and how to keep. We have a good school system that many people in Vermont, most people in Vermont, really appreciate and support, and that's part of the reason why our taxes are so high, is that people keep approving school budgets. But it is a situation that we need to fix, that's for sure. It's a question of how we fix it, that where there will be political disagreements and a lot of oxen potentially being gored.
Sacred oxen?
Yes, sacred
Yes.
and secular.
Well, it will be interesting too, because we always have the Brigham decision in the wings, and so he will still, whatever we put forward has to be in line with the Brigham decision, for better or for worse. So that'll be interesting too. Anything else? Well, I want to quickly touch on, we want to talk about something that happened on the Vermont press scene. But before we do, I was fascinated, Leah, by this theme that has come up a lot recently about the voters have spoken. And I always find that interesting. I'd love to hear both of your thoughts because, on the one hand, yes, we saw some change in seats. We saw some change in the makeup of, Dem to Republican. But, when lawmakers say, well, this is what the voters have told us, I always find that fascinating because at the end of the day, you never really know why someone checked the box they checked when they're voting. And so I'm wondering how much credence should we really give to, the voters have spoken, or is it just an easy place to slip in whatever it is you hope the voters are telling you?
Well, I mean, the voters elected significantly more Republicans than they did 2 years ago, but they elected a lot more Democrats than they did Republicans. So it kind of depends on how you're counting things. I think it's clear there was a reaction to taxes and affordability concerns, particularly, I think, the school tax situation. I think that was the big driver. It is, I think the governor in his address did somewhat overstate the case when he claimed to have a functional majority based on who represents what kind of communities. Most of the legislature represents the left behind communities, as he called them. And that's true, but a lot of these left behind communities chose to elect Democrats anyway. What you do with that, I'm not sure. I think that, the legislature, the legislative leadership has an obligation to try to work with the governor. I think there was a message sent there. I think there's also a message that the governor needs to work with the Democrats. There are more Democratic voters, generally speaking, in Vermont than Republican voters. And they voted for Democrats presumably because they think the Democratic agenda is better for them and for the state. If I voted for a legislator who then did not pursue the agenda they ran on, I would be disappointed. So I think it can't be a one-way street. It can't be everybody coming over to the governor's side. It really does need to be coming together. And I would love to see it happen, even if it meant that the state would pursue more moderate policies than I might personally prefer. I think it's more important that we all get on the same page than the details of what exactly we try to enact.
Well, and it's important that we develop functional policies that achieve the outcomes that we intended, rather
Or at
than.
least get us closer to there.
Leah, any thoughts?
I thought it was interesting that he did not mention anything about the pressure being put on him to declare a homeless crisis. It was interesting he didn't even say, and here's my view on that, or here's where I stand on that versus these other issues we're highlighting. And the fact he didn't bring it up at all made me think that I don't think it was right to not mention it in the sense that, like, you just can't tiptoe around it. You're going to have to go right through the fire, right? I mean, we have a serious issue in this state, compared with the rest of the country. I think there are only other couple of other states that are dealing with the same level of this, homelessness kind of per capita, but just outright homelessness really as well. So I think, what we all know is that we have enough issues now, regardless of your party politics, that we need to fix, that we all agree we need to fix, right? Like housing, taxes, we need to figure out education, cost of living. What do we do about homelessness? So, you know, there was something Ezra Klein said on his podcast a while back, who's at the New York Times. He said, "I am tired of discussing partisan politics. I don't want to do it anymore. I'm not interested at all in the two sides anymore. I am looking at outcomes only. I'm sick of fighting about process with no outcomes. Let's focus on the outcomes and then what process needs to happen to get to them." Because getting into how we do it being this endless squabble with no outcomes or no decent outcomes isn't working. Let's aim at the outcomes and work our way back. And I thought that's probably a good way of looking at what are right now some very complex problems, not just for the state, but for the country, because we do often end up fighting over process and then nothing happens, or some mincing version of what we want happens. But we all know that these are the problems and they need fixing. And so it really will come down to compromise on those outcomes and working our way back, hopefully some process that gets us there with all of these things. But I mean, you can't ignore homelessness, right, in this state. We have people who think it's the most important issue. Those people are going to be involved in whatever those compromises are. And Olga knows how I feel about this. I feel like without a thriving middle class, you can't help anyone, whether it's homeless or elderly or others in need. So, I mean, that's not my opinion. That's like economic modeling. Like there's no model where there's no thriving middle class and these things work. Like you have to have it for these things to work. So I think it's just like, maybe part of it is educating ourselves, but also talking to each other and thinking about those outcomes, you know, cause we all want to have a good life in Vermont for everyone.
Thank you. Yes.
Yep. And I think there are opportunities. There are advantages to being in Vermont. We have assets. We may not have, you know, great oil reserves, but you know, there are a great many positives about Vermont and things that draw people to Vermont in spite of the high cost of living here. Mm-hmm. You know, we do still have a net in migration in Vermont somehow. So, you know, there are things we can do. And that's, again, getting back to the final section of the governor's speech, where he tried to emphasize the positives and the things that have been done and the things that we can do if we work together. So, you know, let's hope that the election triggered a realization among all parties that there is a need to address the problems we face. There is not going to be any benefit in a partisan standoff. And the people of Vermont, whatever other messages they were sending, they elected a mixed government, and they have done that consistently since Phil Scott took office. Republican governor, Democratic legislature. So, you know, if the voters aren't saying, "You guys go and figure it out," then I don't know what they are saying.
Thank you. In the last 10 minutes we have, I want to shift gears to talk about an announcement that came out of 7 Days. And it is a new series they're going to be running called Ways and Means. And it's a look at the way government is functioning. And I'm sure it will go...
The way the legislature is functioning.
Oh, sorry. Legislature is functioning. Thank you, John. But on the one hand, it sounds very exciting. John and Leah, we all read the announcement on 7 Days. But it could also be a little tricky, given the donors. And I'll have John give us more detail in a second. But before I do that, I do feel, before we dive into this conversation, we do have to note that John used to work for 7 Days. And that even though I am a journalist, I often do the Montpelier Happy Hour with a lawmaker, which I have been straight out told by other journalists is dirty journalism. So there you go. There's all our conflicts of interest laid out on the table right there. So John, you just being at 7 days, you have a little more details in on some of the players in the situation. So I'd love if you would give us a rundown.
Well, the co-founder and publisher of 7 Days, Paula Routley, used her column in this week's paper to announce this initiative. And it's basically they're hiring a reporter for 1 year to take a deep dive on how the legislature functions and how effective it is at lawmaking. This came about in part, as Routley herself put it, in response to the whole property tax mess that we're in because of the unintended consequences of a law passed 2 years ago. So they thought it was a good idea to take a deeper look at how the legislature functions and how well it functions. That in itself is a solid idea. The problem is that this initiative is funded and paid for by two men who are both sharp critics of the legislature. And there's going to be no corresponding look at the Republican executive branch. The two men are Bruce Lisman, who was a high-powered Wall Street financier. He worked for Bear Stearns when the economy collapsed in 2008. He had a bit part in Michael Lewis's book about the economic collapse. He moved to Vermont after that. He became a Republican donor. He's one of the most generous Republican donors in the state. He ran for governor once when in 2016 he lost the primary to Phil Scott. So he clearly is on the conservative side of things. The other donor is Paul Ralston, who is perhaps best known as the founder of the Vermont Coffee Company. Those brown bags and those friend stickers. He is a former Democratic lawmaker, and 7 Days put this in terms of like we got one guy from one side and one guy from the other side of the aisle, so it's okay. But Ralston served like he left the legislature 10 years ago. He was not beloved by his colleagues in the Democratic caucus. And since then, he has eschewed the Democratic label and pursued a fiscally conservative, centrist, third way kind of course, to no particular success. He ran as an independent in the state Senate race in Addison County in 2018 and came in a distant fifth. He ran as an independent, challenging two Democrats. And he described himself at the time as a Phil Scott kind of politician. So, what we have here are two people who are, at least on fiscal issues, on the right. They have both been very critical of Democrats in general and the Democratic legislature in particular. And they are funding a journalistic enterprise that's going to go after the Democratic legislature. And to me, that's just a violation of all kinds of norms of journalism. And I don't know. If I still worked at 7 Days, I would be really upset about it. I think that 7 Days ought to rethink this idea. I certainly wouldn't mind if they found some way to anonymize this situation and broaden out this funding source and also broaden the remit of this reporter to include the executive branch as well as the legislature, because there are tons of questions about how well the executive branch functions. So I don't know where I imagine 7 Days are going to stick to their plan because that's kind of how they operate. But I think it's a terrible idea.
So before we hear from Leah, I just want to check in with you, John. The other thing, and I also want to say the journalist they've hired, whose name I have forgotten at the moment, has a great background, and I'm very excited to see the work she does. In the column there, Patricia also outlined kind of the firewalls that were in place to keep space between the journalist and the donors. But it sounds to you that these firewalls don't sound substantial enough.
Well, I mean, they're not the donors are not going to have any editorial influence in what is reported and how it's reported. But they have established the playing field. They paid for coverage of a certain set of issues and not of a whole bunch of other issues. And the issues they want covered are issues that the coverage that in, that results will almost certainly include some criticism of the legislature. And that will benefit these donors' political interests. It's not a matter of, you know, they're not going to stand over the reporter's shoulder and say, you know, you got to look into this or that or, you know, whatever. But the fact that they are allowed to, you know, they are paying the piper. They are not calling the tune, but they are paying for a certain kind of music, shall we say. And that in itself is highly problematic to me.
Leah, what was your response to what you read?
I have a question just before I respond. Do we know how this alliance came together? Who approached who? How it happened? Was
That's a
this
good
revealed?
question. I don't
We
think they
only
talked
know
about
what
that.
Paula wrote in her column, and she did not address the origin or genesis of this. You know, did Wispin and Rawls approach them? Were they looking for a way to fund a certain project and identified Lisbon and Rawlson, which would be a little better. I don't know how this all came together, but the result to me is questionable.
So just we don't know how this happened. And then second, is 7 days status, is it a 501c3? Is it a what is it?
It's a for-profit enterprise that mostly subsists on advertising, although they do have. They do solicit reader donations. They have a super readers club for people who regularly to supplement their income. They used to do very well just on advertising, but then the pandemic came along, and 7 days advertising is largely in sort of like entertainment and restaurants and stuff like that that were just hammered by the pandemic. And the advertising has never fully recovered. So they have had for ways to supplement what they are doing. And their reporting staff is smaller than it was before the pandemic.
All right. So it sounds like, I mean, without knowing a lot more about 7 days, and I certainly don't want the audience, I'm about to give some criticism, as you know, but people listening need to know that despite the really awful smoke being blown over journalists nationally and locally, that they just wanted, print fake news, and that they have their own agendas, and that they don't care about the traditional values of journalism, which is to objectively cover the news, to do it without, without fear or favor, to do it for the reader, right? That this is for the reader, so the readers can make good decisions in their lives and know what's going on. That is really what most journalists really care about, and they aren't getting paid very well to do it. Most journalists have to have a spouse or someone else in their life who is helping with the household budget to even do the work, because it's very hard work. You're working all hours, calls come in at all different times. News doesn't wait for us to get up in the morning. News is happening 24 hours a day. So just saying that, it used to be that with the advertising model before the internet, newspapers had money. And now what we're seeing is this race to the bottom where, the internet can have endless ads. There's all these additional pieces of competition digitally, right, with Google and Facebook, and they're taking all the ad revenue. So just for people who are listening, the reason why newspapers' quality has generally gone down and less staff and less money to go around is because of technology and models changing and just less resources. So there's a lot of creative solutions people are trying to pursue. This sounds like a creative solution 7 days is trying to pursue. But the problem is once you get politics involved in funding journalism, usually the journalism can't be truly objective. And so, just for people who aren't aware of how this works, I know you guys know this. All journalists know this. You're not supposed to have a financial relationship with anyone related to the news you're writing about, because once you bring in the money, it's very, very hard to stay objective. And the mission is to objectively write about the news. So it is very problematic, even if they're saying that they're not going to hear from these donors. If they're not offering the story of the origin of this alliance, I think it's, first of all, it's bonkers that they didn't do that. And the fact they didn't freely offer transparency about how this came together is a problem, because it makes you think that they don't want to tell us, right? So they do need to, if I were the journalist being hired for this, I would want to know what the origin of this was at the very least. It doesn't excuse bringing donors in to fund journalism, but it'd be nice to hear that maybe 7 days talked to them and there was something where 7 days had initiated this, not the donors. You know, for example, if a source came to me and said, I want you to write about something I think is important and here's some money, I would have to say no. I would have to write about it because I thought it was important as a journalist for my readers. You can't have a donor in that relationship. And I think the other problem about not hearing the behind the scenes on the origins of this deal is, how do we know the donors aren't going to be weighing in? I mean, they're paying for this. So it's inconceivable that 7 Days wants us, the readers, to believe that their donors are not going to make clear what they think about the coverage, right? Like, these high-level donors are definitely going to be calling 7 Days saying, this is what we think about what you're doing. Here's our opinion. And that is going to potentially introduce bias, especially if they are the ones providing the money. If this writer, Olga said a new writer is being hired for this, Ways and Means Pop. This writer is reliant on the donor's continued cooperation in paying their salary. How is that writer not going to feel some kind of pressure to make those donors happy in what they're writing? And that's the problem with this kind of an arrangement. I know you both know this, but just for people listening, you don't want to have a writer under any financial pressure. You want them to, they're going to already have enough pressure being a journalist with very limited funds and a very limited salary, but you don't want to introduce powerful donors who have more money and more power in the relationship. It creates a power imbalance, and it's not a good situation for journalism.
Thank you. Thank you, Leah.
I would add one other little note, which is that 7 days since the pandemic, its staff covering state house issues particularly has shrunk dramatically. They have basically become largely a Chittenden County paper with occasional forays into Montpelier. And so this coverage will be a predominant part of 7 days coverage of state issues as a whole. And again, as I said earlier, there's going to be no corresponding focus on the executive branch, which I could, I wrote a piece about this, and I came up off the top of my head with about a dozen things that were worthy of, journalistic investigation regarding the executive branch. But that's not going to happen. What's going to appear in the pages of 7 days and on their website is largely this. And that creates an issue of balance, even if the reporting is 100% straight and not at all affected by the presence of two wealthy donors.
Interesting.
Yeah. Have the donors indicated how long they're willing to fund this enterprise? Like, is this all carefully structured? Meaning, for example, if you have a donor coming in, it's already a problem, right? But there are ways to head off components of the problem. If you were going to go this far, which you shouldn't, but if you were, you'd want to at least know that the donor's money is covered for a certain amount of time so that whatever you write about,
I
they can't
think they
just
said
pull it
1 year.
out. Yeah, they can't just pull the rug out from under you if they don't like what you're writing. You think it's for a year?
I
It's
think
meant
she
to
said
be a
1 year.
1 year enterprise. I don't know
Okay.
what might happen at the end of a year if this is going to be the end of it no matter what, or if there might be some provision for extending it if, all parties are happy with it. And I don't know what would happen if Lisbon and Ralston said after 6 months, gee, we don't think this is going anywhere. We're pulling the plug. Presumably 7 days is getting the money up front.
I thought that's what it said in the article, actually.
Could be,
That the money is secured for 1 year.
I mean, I think there are models to be looked at that, and I'm not going to get into all the models I've seen that are sort of happening right now, but there are these sort of hybrid models happening. But ultimately, your best bet is donors who are anonymized, as John Walters had mentioned. Like if a newspaper says, hey, here's five issues we think need urgent attention, we think our readers want to read about. We need everyone to vote with their dollars. We're not going to know who voted for what. But whichever issues win, I've always argued this with various news organizations in New York. Why don't you have winning issues? People will feel excited to vote with a dollar for the one they like. And, if they see one is like gaining, if somebody says we need at least X amount, we need to hit this threshold to write about it, people who want it written about will be motivated to donate. But at least you won't know who the donors are, so there's no influence between the writers and the donors. Yeah, I feel like there are ways to do this, as John has pointed out, if we really want to be creative, but it shouldn't be initiated by those with the most power and the most money.
And we are in a bit of an experimental phase of journalism in this country because of the digital age. Entities are trying out a lot of new models, and there'll probably be some missteps along the way, and this site, to me, is one of them.
Well, unfortunately, we've gone over time, but it was really wonderful to hear from Leah McGrath Goodman and John Walters today. The Montpelier Happy Hour on WLP Brattleboro totally flubbed that. We'll be back on Friday at 2 o'clock, and of course, we'll rebroadcast it every Wednesday morning and wherever you find your podcasts. Take care, everyone. Have a good weekend.
Happy New Year.